Okay, looks like everything is in order. Hello, everyone. I'm here with Dr. Jordan Peterson, and a lot of you probably know of him, and he's been making quite the buzz. Hi, Jordan. Thank you so much for joining me on this chat. I'm really excited to start to get to the topics at hand. How are you doing today?
Good, tired, good.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I know you told me that there are some very specific things that you'd like to kind of talk with me about today. And because we don't have much time, I just want to kind of jump right into it. So, you wanted to talk a bit about postmodernism and their view on categories. Did you want to just kind
Yeah,
of
well,
expand
there's
on that?
something I've been trying to. I mean, obviously, this discussion about pronouns has attracted a tremendous amount of attention, and it's attracted a tremendous amount of attention for complex reasons that it's not obvious why everyone would focus on it for such a long period of time. It's been about 40 days now, about 130 print articles, and I would say maybe upwards of 3 million people have been watching the goings-on online. We haven't even counted the number of YouTube videos and that sort of thing that have been generated as a consequence of it, and the two demonstrations at the University of Toronto and the exchange of letters. It's been absurdly controversial, and that means that there's something going on that people really haven't put their finger on. And I've been thinking about it at multiple levels of analysis, and there's one very deep level of analysis that I don't think anyone has addressed, and I would think about it as a cognitive level of analysis, and it has to do with the nature of categorization itself. So I remember a long while back I read a paper on why human beings have two hemispheres, the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. And roughly speaking, the left hemisphere, and this is very roughly speaking, the left slash linguistic hemisphere attempts to impose predictable structure on the world, simplifying it. It's not exactly an ideological simplification, it's more like a practical simplification, because the world is so complex that unless you chunk it into categories, it overwhelms you. And so you have to chunk it into categories. And those categories aren't exactly descriptions of things or objects, they're more like tools for operating in the world. And then the right hemisphere keeps track of anomalies and exceptions and tries to build those slowly into the category system so that it doesn't blow the category system. And so there was an example of this that a researcher named Goldberg offered. He had trained a neural network to recognize images of fish and the same neural network to recognize images of birds. But when he showed it a penguin, then it blew the category structure so that all fish became birds and all birds became fish. Now, the postmodernists like Derrida claimed that category structures were primarily tools of power and oppression, which to me is an absurd claim, because that's not their primary use, even though that may be one of their consequences and one of their occasional uses. And he became very, very concerned about who the category systems marginalized and what the consequence of that was for them. And that got tangled in a sense into the Marxist identity politics routine, because the Marxist identity politics people picked up the idea of the excluded and marginalized and sort of transformed them into the equivalent of Marx's oppressed working class, and then started to agitate for them. And the Democrats in the United States, for example, transformed their focus from working class concerns, say, to identity politics concerns. And there's been some notion that that was part of the resurgence of Marxism as an ideological doctrine. Anyways, it's a really fundamental problem. The categories exclude, but then if you include the excluded in the category, you blow the category structure. Now, this is partly why the right-wing Christians, for example, were so opposed to the idea of homosexual marriage. So what's happening very rapidly is that because the binary category has been let's say violated, that's one way of thinking about it, you get an explosion of chaotic identities. And so it's gone from, say, two to the proposed, I suppose, three, which would have been what the formulators of the legislation, I think, were hoping for. to, say, 31 in New York and 70 online. And then there's this additional explosion, which is being promoted by people who aren't really concerned so much with the categories of gender identity, but with other categories like human versus non-human identity. And so those are the people that have become known as otherkins or even transabled, right, who are claiming, but on the same logical grounds, that's the problem. It's on the same logical grounds, is they're claiming a non-categorical identity that transcends the human. And if it's only subjective, then there's no, and you already agree with the first step, there's no way of logically agreeing with the second step. And so it's a really interesting example of how, say, binary categories maintain order. And then if you violate them to include those who are excluded, what you produce is an upswelling of unmanageable chaos, which seems to be the state we're in. So one of the things I wanted to ask you is, I think this is happening, this has happened on two fronts. It's happened with the requests of gay people to be included in marriage. And then now it's happened as a consequence of the request of transgendered people to be included in, although flipping the gender categories. And it's especially true with the so-called non-binary gendered types of, and so I just wondered what you think about all that.
Well, there's so much. So I've been thinking about this a lot, maybe not in the same kind of use of the same words, but very much along the same lines. And I think it's interesting that you talk about categories. One could look at it also as not just the violation or the changing of the definition of a category, but the creation of an entirely new category, not just male, female, but now an entirely new category, which not necessarily threatens male and female, but it threatens the dichotomy, as you said, the binary. I find it interesting because I can't see how there is any third gender, because there is nothing more than male and female. I mean, where does this come from? There's nothing more than male, female, and maybe like,
well, that's exactly the problem of the, that's right. Well, that's exactly the problem of the category, is that once you're outside that, then you're anywhere, as far as I can tell.
And if you can create an identity out of nothing, based out of nothing in reality, then you're basically claiming the status of a demigod. And it just doesn't make sense.
Well, in fact, the otherkins are consciously claiming the status of demigods, because they proclaim that they are such creatures as elves or fairies or orcs or whatever their imagination conjures up. But, you know, that's the other thing, too, is that in Bill C-16, there's actually an assault on the concept of reality, because identity is technically unmoored from its biological substrate. And so that means it's unmoored from the objective. And as soon as it's unmoored from the objective, then it's subjective and in principle can be anything. So, here's a problem with the classically transgendered people, and I presume that you would fit into that category, the argument isn't so much about the category of gender. The argument is about which category you're going to be in. Uh-huh. But then what that seems to do is immediately open the door, or has opened the door, to, I would say, a philosophical assault on the concept of gender itself, that culminated, for example, in Dr. Nicholas Matt's claim on TVO's The Agenda, when he was debating me, that there were no biological differences between men and women, and that's what the science over the last four decades has claimed. A remarkable, remarkable claim.
Basically, it's not correct that there is such a thing as biological sex. And I'm a historian of medicine. I can unpack that for you at great length if you want, but in the interest of time, I won't. So that's a very popular misconception. So essentially, when in my transgender studies classes, what we're doing is looking at actual research and identifying ways that current social issues related to trans people or things that are associated with trans, such as free speech arguments and claims, how that connects to the way that people are thinking, the way that research has been framed, the history is.
Give us some of the other pronouns.
And then the dissolution of identity into this unbelievable chaos that even appears to transcend the dimensions of species. I got an article today from a viewer in England who sent me the transcripts, I believe it was of a German philosopher's talk, who claimed that our recognition of the biological sex of animals is nothing but an artificial imposition of a arbitrary ideological construct, which is exactly what you'd claim if you decided that the underlying biology was irrelevant. This is why I think the evolutionary biologists are next in the sights of the social justice warriors.
Absolutely. I think there is a degree to which even traditional transgender people do still maybe not assault, but certainly threaten the category of male and female. Certainly. I try to argue for why we need to consider a definition of woman that maybe includes someone like me. I don't demand it. I just argue for it. But then there's the other thing, the other matter that you seem to talk about more, which is the inclusion of a new category such as non-binary and what that means to the meaning of gender. But I think including a trans woman into the category of woman, maybe not equally, but similarly, threatens the definition of gender in a similar way, maybe not assaults.
It definitely destabilizes it. And the question is, what exactly should be done about that? Because, you know, there's been a claim among, say, Western philosophers since the beginning of the philosophical tradition, that the basis of civilization itself, the structural basis, is roughly speaking, the nuclear family. And another thing I think that's come under assault, and this is certainly something that was picked up by the Christian fundamentalists early, was that the dissolution of these category structures also begins to destabilize the nuclear family. And the problem with that is we don't exactly know what the consequences of that will be. We do know, the scientific literature is quite clear on this as far as I'm concerned, children who are raised in intact families with two biological parents do far better on pretty much everything that's measured. And so now, of course, the problem with the family, and you can see this reflected in, say, Kathleen Wynne's new legislation on, I think it's called All Families Are Equal, that's the bill, is that if any arrangement whatsoever between people can be family, then there's no such thing as family anymore. And if there's no such thing as family, well, then we don't know what will happen. And the problem, too, is that it seems to me that it's in the interest of people who are who do not fit easily into categories to not destabilize the main culture too badly. And there's a reason for that, is the main culture right now is actually pretty tolerant. If you destabilize a culture enough, it will become rapidly intolerant. And then the first thing that happens is those who are identifiably different are the first targets of an intolerant culture. So it seems to me that it's incumbent on the LGBT, et cetera, community, if they want to request inclusion, then they also have to figure out how that can be done in a way that doesn't destabilize the entire category structure, because it risks doing that. So now you had some arguments about why the category of woman should be expanded to include people like you. Now, obviously, you're doing everything in your power to present yourself to the world in a manner that makes you easily categorizable.
Absolutely. And I guess I don't necessarily even think of it that way. You know, I don't think I want to be seen as woman, so I'm going to do all these things to be viewed as woman. I do all these things because I am a woman. I do all these things just because it comes naturally to me. And the end product happens to be a subject that in people's minds is easily registerable.
Well, that's also, I would say, that's an act of politeness on your part. You know, so one of the things people concluded when I first made my videos is that I wouldn't use he or she to refer to, well, say, someone like yourself who wants to be referred to as she. And my attitude about that was never that. But having thought through it further, I also realized that my natural behavioral proclivity, and I think that of most people, is to refer to someone by the pronoun that addresses their appearance. Because it's a pronoun use is actually rather casual, right? You do it unthinkingly and automatically. And you address a person in keeping with the manner in which they manifest themselves. And you're doing that. And you're saying that that's also, or maybe even primarily, a manifestation of an inner drive, but obviously the manner in which that inner drive is manifests itself is also socially, it's part of a social negotiation.
Of course. And that's probably my argument for choosing a definition of woman that includes me, because for the sake of communication, it just seems makes sense. Language is what we use to communicate with one another. We don't want to corrupt it. The better we communicate the real world to one another, the better we use language. And I think there would actually be more confusion if people referred to me as he and sir and stuff.
Right. Okay. So part of your case is that there's actually no way of addressing you that doesn't produce some confusion. And so using she is the simplest.
Produces less confusion.
Aha, uh-huh, okay. Well, that's okay. That's an interesting argument. Okay, so what would you say if I said you could make a case that your mere existence is a threat to categorical order? And so I could say that your duty, as a consequence, despite the potential violation of your own sense of self, would be to what? To deny your own inner impulses and conform. Because not doing so, I understand that that comes at a personal cost, and I'm not trying to minimize that cost. And I'm also not saying that you should do this, but
No, I understand.
I think you could make a case that it's like the social obligation of someone who doesn't fit into a fundamental category to, it's a tricky one, man, to fit in regardless, because it's so threatening not to. No. I mean, you could make the same case about artists. That's the problem, right? You could make the same case about anyone that doesn't fit in. And often people who don't fit in are necessary. So it's a very tricky thing to think through.
Well, I'd like to come back to the argument for usefulness of language. Like how useful is a definition of woman? You know, for the most part, using a definition of woman, someone who was born with XX chromosomes and you know, can give birth and, you know, all of those things, that's very useful because it describes the vast majority of cases that you will find in real world.
Right. And it facilitates certain kinds of interactions. I mean, obviously there's...
So I don't see that it's necessarily conflicting to consider in a given situation where someone maybe was not born biologically female, to consider the use of a different definition of woman if it's communicatively useful. And that way we don't have to threaten categories because we are still committed to.
Okay. So let me ask you some questions about that. So let's assume that your point is well taken. Then I might say, if you're born a man and you wish to be treated as a woman, what are the minimal obligations that you have to undertake in order to be granted that, let's say, privilege? You know, because the way this is framed, right, the way it's been framed in discussions with me so far is that it's a matter of respect to use someone's pronouns. And I think that's nonsense, because when I see people on the street and I refer to them as he or she, it has nothing to do with respect. It's just the most casual of communication intents. And so I don't buy the respect thing. But let's say you're making a case that the most straightforward thing is to include you or people that are in the same position as you. So what do you think your obligations are, your responsibilities are to the social compact, let's say, in order to be given that, I got to say privilege, it's something like that, because
that's
it's an exception.
Okay.
Right?
Privilege is fine with me. I think that considering that, my answer to that question would be to be regarded as the gender that you identify as commonsensically within your culture. Maybe that's your obligation.
Yeah, okay. Well, that seems to be at least reasonable, because at least then you don't make it any more awkward for people to interact with you than it has to be. I was talking to an artist the other day named Jonathan Paggio, and we were talking about the issue of non-categorical identity, and he was talking to me about mythological stories of the welcoming of strangers. There's a very strong tradition of hospitality in most cultures, and if a stranger shows up, you're to welcome them into your house. But they're supposed to behave when they're in your house. So they're not supposed to steal your...
Exactly.
Right, and rape your women and so forth, right?
Yes, exactly.
So so there's an obligation on both sides.
Like what Gavin McInnes said about trans women who transition from male to female. He said that, you know, if you're going to go to Japan and you're going to go live in Japan, you need to, like, speak their language, communicate with them, adopt their customs, take your shoes off when you enter the house, refer by their last name, all these things. That's just what you do. That's what a stranger does if they don't want to be considered a stranger anymore.
Right, exactly that.
Yeah.
Something, well, so it seems to me that there needs to be a discussion about responsibilities. If the excluded other wants to be included, the way to be included isn't to blow apart the category structure. It's to,
exactly.
to behave nicely when you're welcomed into the house. It's something like that. Okay, so I've got a more vicious question to ask you, I would say. This is a rough one, man.
It, the majority of this live stream would be considered transphobic by probably every the majority of trans people. I love it. I think this is such good conversation.
Okay. So here's another problem. One of the things that I've been thinking through the last couple of weeks is the idea of discrimination, because discrimination and judgment and categorization aren't that easy to tell apart. And you have to be discriminating or you'll do anything all the time. So you have to make
choices
and you have to exclude. Now, one of the things that's very characteristic about female sexual behavior among human beings is it's very exclusionary. So, for example, among chimpanzees, the females are promiscuous maters. Now, the dominant males have more offspring, but that's because they chase the subordinate males away from the females when they're in estrus, when they're in heat. The females that are in heat, they'll mate with any male. The dominant males chase away the subordinate males, so they get more offspring. But it has nothing to do with female, let's say, preference. Human beings are very strange in this regard, and this is maybe why we're so different from chimpanzees, even though we share a common ancestor. And one of the big differences is that human females are very, very choosy sexually. And so this is why, for example, you have twice as many female ancestors as male ancestors. And it's a hard thing to think about conceptually, but basically it means that on average, you'd get that outcome if on average every female produced two offspring and every male only produced one. And that would mean some males produce far more than one and some produce zero. So there's differential sexual success in males and females and human beings. It's because of female sexual selectivity. So this is what females choose for. They choose men who are across or above them in dominance hierarchies. They tend to choose for health. They tend to choose for appearance. They tend to choose for productivity that's manifested often in status, and so forth. And so what that means is that a minority of males are found very sexually attractive and the majority of males not. So my point is that one of the most fundamental rights that, say, feminists want to retain is the right to absolute sexual choice in their partners. But they don't understand that that's based on exactly the forms of discrimination that they're always arguing against. So because people sleep with someone of their own race, they sleep with someone of their own religion, roughly the same age. They generally go after healthy people. They generally go after attractive people. And so every single dimension of discrimination that you can possibly imagine governs sexual choice. If you completely eradicate the justification for discrimination, which I would also say is the same justification for freedom of association, you also blow out the element of sexual choice. Now, the question I wanted to ask you is, considering you as a potential sexual partner is going to be distressing to the majority of people, is that acceptable?
Yes.
Why?
Because I'm an anomaly. It's just not something people are comfortable with. The fact that I was born a different way than I am now, even if they are attracted to me. It makes my dating life a bit harder,
right,
and more complicated. But
definitely.
I'm a huge proponent of discrimination. I think that's 100% within people's rights. I would never call someone transphobic because they don't want to sleep with me because I was born one way and don't. That's their preference. That's their prerogative. It's 100% people's right to discriminate.
So do you think that there's any ways, obviously you've thought through this through a lot, like the part of the problem here is that distinguishing that from forbidden forms of discrimination is very, very difficult conceptually. Like, it's not obvious why it's okay to discriminate against someone sexually. This happened in Brave New World in Huxley's novel, where any form of sexual discrimination was regarded as socially inappropriate, such that if someone asked you to have sex with them, it was your moral obligation not only to do it, but to be happy about it. The basic hypothesis was, or the basic slogan was, everyone belongs to everyone else. that's the final limit of the absence of discrimination. So, but why do you think that discrimination of that sort is okay?
I believe in equality and lack of discrimination, equal treatment under the law. That is kind of where it ends for me.
Right.
Very much free market in my thinking.
Well, that free market example is an interesting one, because maybe the reason that it's okay for other people to discriminate is because we want to retain the right for ourselves to discriminate. Because maybe it's something like you're willing to have people reject you as a potential sexual partner as long as you're also allowed the privilege to reject other people as potential sexual partners.
Take the example, the whole transgender people in washrooms thing. I believed when that was going on, it's kind of died down now, but I believe when that was going on, that the state shouldn't be saying trans people aren't allowed in the washroom of their choosing or shouldn't. I was like, that's up to the business owners to make that decision. Is there's a business down the road, a restaurant that wouldn't let me, you know, use the washroom, the female washroom? So be it. I'll just go to a different restaurant, and that's what I'm. So I'm very free market thinking, and I think discrimination is something that needs to, the right to discriminate is something that needs to be protected at all costs.
Well, it certainly seems to have to be protected to some degree. Like, I think the sexual choice conundrum, I mean, there are horrors on both sides of it, right? The first horror is, well, if you obliterate sexual discrimination, then you have to allow yourself to be the sexual target of whoever, whenever. That seems like a pretty bad solution. And it's certainly not one that I think particularly women would rapidly accept.
And that's such an assault on individual's agency.
Right, right. It's the ultimate assault on an individual's agency. But the problem is to maintain that right to choice is to also maintain the right to discriminate. And then putting the boundaries on what you're allowed to discriminate against is very, very tricky. Like, I think we've gone far too far in the anti-discrimination direction. It's very difficult for people on campuses now to aggregate themselves in gender uniform groups. And I'm not sure that's a good idea. Like, it seems to me that men should be allowed to hang around with men if they want to, and that women should be allowed to hang around with women when they want to, and that actually that right might be necessary for the proper development of masculinity and femininity. One final thing. This is another horrible thing that no one ever talks about. I mean, the data suggests that men who are homosexual have a very large number of sexual partners. And that makes sense to me, because men tend not to say no to sexual opportunities. And so if you have men with men, it's like no one says no. So there's lots of sexual activity. So one of the things I'm curious about is if marriage is expanded on any other grounds merely than the legal grounds, which I think aren't sufficient to even maintain marriage as an institution. If marriage is expanded to include same-sex couples, say, what are the obligations of the same-sex couples once they're actually married? So does that mean that, and I know the literature on this, that the suggestion is that most male homosexuals who get married don't give up their promiscuous ways. Well, it seems to me that if you don't give up your promiscuous ways, then you're actually not playing the game of marriage. And that's one of the discussions about responsibility that I don't think has been had in public life. If you want to be part of the game, then in principle, you also have to follow the rules. That doesn't mean everyone who's heterosexual, who's married,
I agree. Lest you absolutely obliterate the very fundamental building blocks of a society and a culture. That's what happens when you violate very important categories like marriage.
Right, that's right. We don't know what the fundamentals, we don't really understand the fundamentals. I mean, people have made philosophical claims. I would say gender identity is a fundamental. Children learn that very early. And marriage is a fundamental, and the nuclear family is a fundamental. And, you know, we have no idea how many of those fundamentals can be challenged before the whole bloody thing shakes and falls down. And it, unless you want it to shake and fall down. And, all right, so good. Well, that was good. So maybe we'll get a chance to do this again.
Everyone, please check the link below to register for the Right to Offend conference on November 19th. It's going to be great. We'll be talking about similar topics surrounding political correctness, free speech, and so on. And I wanted to have this live stream because Dr. Peterson wasn't able to, wouldn't be able to make it in person for that conference. So I just wanted to use this time to promote it. Thank you so much, Dr. Peterson.
All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.